Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Welcome to the Brandel Chambly podcast. I'm Jaime Diaz. It's wonderful to have Brandel here. Feels like we've already played a year and it's only March. Lots happened and continues to happen at a very high rate of speed and I think with a lot of significance as well. Brandel, good morning.
Good morning, Scottsdale.
Jaime, how are you? Getting up early.
Yeah, well, you wake up early out here in the desert.
Well, it's beautiful, you know, to start the day when it's nice days, start them early. By the way, let's start with something you commented about, and we have talked about also at Golf Channel on the air, is Dustin Johnson choosing to pass on the Olympics in Tokyo. And, you know, it's a hot button issue. I'm sure he's going to receive some criticism. I can also see justification for his reasoning. Let's just start with your thoughts about it.
Well, fill me in. What was his reasoning?
Well, I think his reasons were that the season gets extremely crowded around that time. Obviously, it's after the majors, but it's only 2 weeks after the final major, which is the Open Championship. And then he prioritizes the FedEx Cup and wants to come back and play well on the PGA Tour. And he thinks the disruption of going to Tokyo would put him at a disadvantage. I'm paraphrasing and I'm interpreting a little bit, but I think it's mostly about feeling like my main job is to win tournaments and majors in particular, and having the Olympics be in my head, so to speak, as either a priority or as something that might be a distraction is counterproductive to that.
Yeah, okay, that's what I read. I was wondering if there was something I had missed. It just sounds to me, he's, as they say, an independent contractor. He's free to do as he pleases, but you know, I find it odd that somebody can disrupt their season, sort of using his inference or terminology, to go to Saudi Arabia and play for appearance money, but can't find the time to go to Japan to play for their country. He may pass it off as a personal decision, but you know, he's called upon as the number one player in the world. He's in a position to play for his country, and he may say, well, my participation is, it's entirely up to me. And that's certainly true. But I think he hasn't really thought out what it would mean to the Olympics if he did participate as the number one player in the world. Obviously, it would raise the interest level a great deal of the Olympics that the number one player in the world was there. It would, I think, globally, you know, it would, you know, raise the possibility of a great sort of back and forth at the Olympics. Imagine the DJ Rory battle. We have this debate all the time. Who's the best when they're at the best? DJ has recently said when he's at his best, he doesn't think anybody can beat him, which is to say, if he goes to the Olympics and he's at his best, he should win the gold. In the past Olympics, he skipped because of Zika. That's why he skipped. The World Health Organization confirmed there were no cases of Zika amongst any athletes in the 2016 Olympics. So he passed ostensibly because of Zika, which turned out to be a non-issue at the 2016 Olympics. Now he's passed in the 2020 because he says it just doesn't fit in his schedule. If he were to go play again, it would raise the interest level. It would increase the odds of a compelling back and forth between the USA and another country, or DJ and Rory, or DJ and Bryson DeChambeau, or better yet, DJ and Hideki Matsuyama. But beyond that, as it increases the interest level in the Olympics, it would raise the interest level in golf being in the Olympics and would go a long way towards ensuring golf's participation in the Olympics. I'm sure the Olympic Committee and those who decide such things, seeing the best players in the world skip the Olympics, might find it a reasonable possibility to disinclude golf in the Olympics. But as it is, golf being in the Olympics ensures that other countries would do their best to facilitate golf programs in their country and by extension, grow the game. So in this small way, he's working to grow the game globally. He may not know it. He may not have been told that by his manager, but that's in fact what his participation in the Olympics is all about. It is him in a position to help grow the game and him being oblivious to that obligation as the number one player in the world. Again, anybody who, you know, can take time in a busy schedule to fly to Saudi Arabia. And again, you know, all the baggage that comes with that for appearance money. I just think it's a dubious argument for them to make that they can't find the time to hop on their private jet, fly to Japan and spend 6 days, 5 days representing their country. I think it sets a bad precedent. I think especially coming on the excuse of him missing the 2016 Olympics, now back-to-back Olympics. You know, you think about it. I mean, you know, in tennis, Djokovic, Nadal, Murray all played in 2016. Federer did not play because he said he had a knee injury, but you go back to 2012, Federer lost in the final to Andy Murray. These are individual contractors as well. They're free to come and go and do as they please. Serena and Venus played in the 2016 Olympics. The very best from other individual sports who are free to do as they please find their way to the Olympics. And if you go back to the 2016 Olympics, the USA only had one medal in golf. Kuchar got the bronze. We didn't have, you know, Rose obviously got the gold, Stenson got the silver, and the women's MB Park, Lydia Ko, Shanshan Feng. There were no players from the U.S. that medaled. So it would, I think, behoove the United States to put their best foot forward, put their best team there, constitute a dream team for the Olympics, which would be, you know, at this point, DJ, Justin Thomas and Colin Morikawa, or Bryson DeChambeau. So the chances of us putting our dream team, our best foot forward, at least on the men's department, is gone if Bryson doesn't want to fulfill his obligation to compete for his country in the Olympics. So, yeah, he's free to do as he pleases, but it was a dubious explanation for him not choosing to play.
Yeah, you make a lot of strong points. I don't disagree with any of them strongly myself. I think it is a close call. I do think the Saudi Arabia decision, even though it came at the beginning of the year when the season was, you know, less structured and there was a sort of a warm-up period, relatively speaking, for the majors, if that's the priority, it's still such a hot-button issue morally. And the players, you know, a lot of players went. Tony Finau went. A lot of guys who have, you know,
couldn't believe that one. I
just don't think that issue resonates with athletes to the same extent it might resonate. And I'm not, this is not an excuse. Just
not as long as they're being bought.
I mean, they turn the other cheek. There's that. And there's also, you know, a member was murdered and in Khashoggi and, you know, the leaders.
All it takes is a cursory look at those whose job it is to judge such things on where Saudi Arabia stands in terms of human rights. And it's a long way to go for money to legitimize the most repulsive regime on planet Earth. And to go there and pretend as if everything's wonderful in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, that's another issue. And we've talked about that. But to go there and accept the appearance money and then not go to the Olympics to play for your country.
I think that's the...
I think I think that, you know, if I were somebody advising a player who had gone to Saudi Arabia and who's in a position to go represent their country, it's like, you know, I don't know how you do one and not the other.
Yeah, I think that's the wide disconnect there that makes DJ's decision seem more difficult to defend. However, again, I'll play devil's advocate for a moment and just say there's a lot of abuses in the world and many countries where golf is played. And to draw that line of, well, we can't come here because this regime is morally repulsive, or
you don't draw the line nowhere.
Well,
you draw
somewhere. I'm just bringing up the point that
you don't argue all the way to the bottom.
I understand. Yeah. And I'm not really defending. I'm only presenting the mitigation of many regimes being ones that.
But it looks to me as if he's drawn the line where they're willing to pay him a few million dollars.
Okay, well,
that's my point.
I got it.
And I've been a huge fan of Dustin Johnson since he first came on the tour. I've lauded him all through his career, but you know, as he's put the pieces of the puzzle together of his golf game and become a formidable number one player, to bow out of the Olympics, I think it's selfish. And I think he's missing the point of the Olympics. It's not about 1 week of his life. It's about impacting the game globally and elevating the stature of golf's participation in the Olympics. I can remember being in conversations, as I'm sure you have, over the years, whether or not golf was even a sport. I've been in many of those debates with friends of mine who don't necessarily know the game that well, and other random people. And when golf finally is elevated to the status of a sport, our best athletes choose not to play it in the Olympics.
Well, I think this gets to the bigger point, and we'll put, you know, hey, look, I'll give you your due on the Saudi Arabia argument. I think he did make a mistake in terms of playing Saudi Arabia and then pulling from the Olympics. Had he not played in Saudi Arabia, it would be easier to say he wasn't playing in the Olympics.
But well, maybe then he could say, I can't inconvenience myself for a week at the expense
I think the Olympics are not as cut and dry in terms of being the end all be all as an event for the best golfers in the world yet.
Well, if they're looking at it from a selfish point of view, sure, but from a global perspective,
well,
their participation legitimizes golf in the Olympics, first of all, and second of all, it increases the likelihood of elevating the stature of the Olympics, which increases the likelihood of countries where golf is not on anybody's radar of elevating the stature of the game such that they support programs that make it more likely that golfers from all corners of the globe will participate in the game, which
is for
the good of the game.
I think you're also making the case that as the number one player in the world, he has a higher obligation.
A much higher obligation, you know?
And I think that's, you know, certainly conceptually logical. I think, though, he's not the kind of number one, let's say Tiger Woods was, or even Rory McIlroy was. Even though he's been as dominant as anyone except Tiger Woods at the number one position, his public profile is not quite as high, I don't think. Not to say he's factored that in.
That's why he should go to the Olympics.
Well, I don't think his absence is that crucial to the Olympics being successful. The U.S. can still field a very representative team. I don't think Dustin Johnson would actually be that missed. And that's no knock on DJ. It's just simply that it's a world stage. I think it's actually way more meaningful to other countries to get an Olympic gold medal than it would be to a top American player. And that doesn't mean, again, the Olympics.
Well, it'll be more meaningful to those countries if they beat the number one player in the world, is my whole point, because it would make the story more compelling.
I think it would marginally, but not dramatically more important. I think just winning the gold medal in and of itself stands alone as a great feat for certain countries, especially. For example, if John Rahm were to win the gold medal, I think it would be very meaningful to Spain, because John Rahm can walk the street in Spain and probably not be recognized just as Seve Ballesteros could. But as Olympic gold medalist, I think he'd be on the radar of the general sports fan a lot more in Spain. And I'm not saying that that's why DJ doesn't gets a pass. I'm only saying that he definitely is not carrying the flag for America alone. Whereas certain countries, it's really significant that their best player get on the world stage and excel. And that's what really makes the Olympics, those stories more, I think, than the Americans coming in with a pretty dominant type of legacy, certainly in golf, winning again.
I don't know. I disagree. I think the dream team went there and did things in the Olympics. None of them needed to do.
Again, that's a good point.
The idea of the best.
The novelty of the first one was really symbolic and important. I think you'd also make the argument, and I actually kind of do make this argument in my own head. The dream team in a way helped, if not corrupt the Olympics, certainly to refashion it in a way that it's no longer thought of as, you know, the great amateur dream. It's now professional, like everything else at the top of the sports pyramid. And as such, it sort of thwarted the whole amateur ability to come in and have their moment at the Olympics. And that's why golf in the Olympics at all, not to say it doesn't belong, but it's part of this second half of the Olympic movement that I don't think has quite the same emotional impact as what the pure amateur years, centuries of, not centuries, but decades of Olympic achievement have really been about. And so that's why I think it's been diluted slightly in terms of how important the Olympics would be to a professional golfer who's already number one in the world and is after majors. And that's, I think there's a calculation going on. That's how I'm going to make my legacy. It may become that the Olympic gold medal becomes as important or more important than majors or tournament.
Well, victory. Not if the best skip it. And then,
well, I agree. It undermines it slightly. It undermines golf. It slightly. But at the same time, the Olympic movement still, this is a COVID year. There's a lot of, I think, extenuating circumstances going to Tokyo this year. Tokyo itself is a little unsettled about holding the Olympics. I'm not saying it's the Zika thing was, you know, definitely seemed over-dramatized at the time and might have been used as an out. But, you know, we're going to Paris next time at the Olympics, and then we're coming back to the United States. And maybe the Olympic golf movement takes on more momentum at that point.
I'm not sure golf will make it in the Olympics. You know,
well, it's possible. It's possible it won't. But
if the best are skipping it, golf's inclusion is in doubt in the Olympics.
I would think Bryson DeChambeau would want to go to the Olympics because of his high profile, because he hasn't got the same kind of record as DJ yet, and he's still building on it. It could be a great opportunity to get a gold medal.
Again, but as the number one player in the world, you hold the responsibility.
I don't disagree.
You're not invisible. You're not filling a void. You are the best player in the world. And
you know, one thing I would like to see, I'd actually like to see like a World Cup type format where there was a team competition and then maybe an individual crown, just as there was in the Olympic and in the World Cup, the old World Cup where it was, you know, Jack Nicklaus and Johnny Miller or Ben Hogan and Sam Snead. I mean, that was, it didn't get a lot of play, but it was in terms of television and stuff, but it seemed to be important for a while. And it was also a way of two guys sharing in the top spot. And so the odds of winning a gold medal would increase if there was a team competition. I think in order to get a gold medal, again, selfishly, the players might feel more incentivized to go if there was a team competition. That might be an adjustment.
You've made my point for me there. The 1957 World Cup was in Japan.
Yeah.
And Snead was there with his, I forgot who his partner was, but anyway, he got beat by a Japanese team.
It was a big deal then. It was
Japanese golf exploded. And subsequently golf courses grew in Japan and the game grew globally because of this competition. And the fact that they beat, there were no world rankings then, but the fact that they beat, arguably the greatest player of all time at that time, or arguably the greatest player in the world at that time, Sam Snead, elevated the status of golf in Japan such that it became hugely popular. So, you know, that's my whole point about Dustin Johnson for the second time skipping the Olympics.
Okay. I think point made. I think it's got a lot of merit. My mitigating factor in my signing on completely to your argument is, even though he's number one in the world, if they sent Justin Thomas and Bryson and Colin or Xander Schauffele, I don't think people would go, the U.S. is abrogating their responsibility in sending a representative.
No, but they're not putting their best team there. Okay, the world rankings define their best team.
It's not their very best. Yeah, it's not their very best.
Not their best, period. It's not their best team.
Okay. But still be a good Olympics, I think. I mean, I was in Rio. That was a feel-good moment. You know, Justin Rose was very moved when he won that gold medal. Matt Kuchar was very happy with his bronze. It was the first Olympics. It was a success because there was a lot of doubt whether it would be. I think now it's got a little momentum. It could stand a slight setback if Japan doesn't go off quite as well. I don't think it'll kill the Olympics. And I don't think, in other words, if it was Tiger Woods, let's say, in his prime, and his not going would be just a complete, you know, letdown of the whole Olympic golf movement. It's not that. So I'm not giving Dustin a complete pass. I'm only saying I don't think the consequences are that great. And he won't, I don't think, bring down the Olympic movement by himself in golf. But we'll see. You make great points. The Saudi Arabia thing, I think, was a mistake, especially if he didn't plan on playing in the Olympics. And, you know, that golf has that. There's a lot of guys who went to Saudi Arabia and a lot of guys who go to China and a lot of guys who go to a lot of countries that we disagree with, not just disagree with, but whose policies are clearly, if not immoral, certainly don't follow sort of the standard around the world of what human rights should be. So point taken on your point. And I don't disagree. We've gone a long time on that, but let's switch topics and one we talked about last week. You had a very interesting take in the article by Beth Ann Nichols in Golf Week about the setups on the LPGA and the idea that because it was on the anniversary of 20th anniversary of Annika Sorenstam shooting 59, and how few, well, there haven't been any 59 since then for the women. There have been several by the men over time, and also a lot of 60s. I think there's only been one 60, maybe two 60s on the women's tour. Two, I believe, Meg Mallon and recently Jessica Korda. The idea being that women's golf courses are being set up too long for women to shoot those kind of scores and to fully show their talents. And that if they were able to shoot these lower scores more often, they would gain more respect, more attention for being the best players in the world. And there wouldn't be this huge chasm between men's golf and women's golf. Maybe I've summarized it differently than you would, but give me your thoughts on this subject, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I've thought a lot about. I wrote a column about it years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, that the math just didn't add up. I was asked to go 1 year, be the lead analyst at the Founders event here in Arizona after Judy Rankin's husband passed away at the last minute. Sad. So I got the call and I went over, and I can remember, you know, the back nine at that particular golf course here in town had two drivable par fours built as drivable par fours for men. And I remember the LPGA staff came in telling us how they were going to set up the golf course. And I said, you know, in particular, how are you going to set up these drivable par fours? They said, oh, we're just going to leave them at 340 or whatever they were. I said, well, why wouldn't you move them up to 240 or 250? And they said, well, they wouldn't go for them. And I thought, well, they're not going to go for them at 340. There were bunkers now that were like 30 or 40 yards short of these greens, as you would expect on drivable par fours, bringing some risk into play. And, you know, I just started doing some math, and I, as the week went on, paying very close attention to the yardages, it just occurred to me that the LPGA golf courses were set up far too long compared to men's golf courses. At that time, the longest hitter on the LPGA, and the longest hitter on the PGA Tour were separated by 50 yards, and the shortest on the LPGA and shortest on the PGA Tour were separated by 50 yards. Now it's more like 40, but the math still holds. If you, you know, obviously if you multiply 40 times 14 tee shots, right, what are you at? 560 yards. And most of the difference between LPGA and PGA Tour golf courses stop sort of right in that neighborhood, 500 to 800 yards. But they're failing, I think, to recognize the 18 approach shots still have to come to some sort of, I think, a parallel of trajectory and spin such that they have a chance to stop their shots within the same proximity that the players do on the PGA Tour. And then you start to look at scoring averages. You know, there are, you know, many years on the PGA Tour where there's 20, 30 players who average under 70. There are years on the LPGA Tour when there's one, two, three, four, you know, at the most, you know, a handful of players average under 70. And it's not because they lack the skill. It's just because that they're playing golf courses that would be the equivalent of 8,000 yard golf courses on the men's tour. And Beth Ann Nichols, who, you know, is, I think, you know, the foremost authority on the LPGA Tour, her and Steve Eubanks, they're out there every single week, cover it, give their heart and soul to it, pay attention to it, and come at it with great respect. And, you know, it wasn't lost on her. And when you start adding up the scoring comparisons between the LPGA Tour and the PGA Tour, the ones on the PGA Tour, you know, they eclipse the scoring records on the LPGA Tour. And again, it perpetuates a wholly inaccurate stereotype. And, I at the U.S. Women's Open at Champions this past year, it rained. The course was soft. And, you know, I watched, you know, as the players couldn't get on par fives and two, they were hitting fairway metals, fairway woods to par fours. That wouldn't fly on the men's tour. It just would not fly. There would be an outrage. But it's just, you know, dismissed too easily on the LPGA Tour. So again, if you do the math for the approach shots and the tee shots, if the men on average are playing golf courses that are 7,300 yards long, the LPGA Tour should be playing golf courses somewhere around 6,000 yards long. This is not to manipulate in any way scores on the LPGA Tour. It is just to provide an appropriate and corresponding or parallel setup that the men have. Right now, almost every single time you see the LPGA play, they're playing a golf course that's comparatively or would be about 8,000 yards for the PGA Tour. The Olympic, the U.S. Women's Open is going to Olympic. It's going to play at, I think, around 6,500 yards. You know this.
It's a hard.
There are no more longer yardages than in San Francisco, where the air is cold and it's damp, and obviously you're at sea level. You know, even for, you know, I've played San Francisco Golf Club there. It's not a particularly long golf course, but it's the longest short golf course you'll ever play. So, you know, again, 6,500 yards there will play like 7,200 yards, 7,100 yards, which is, you know, that is a stern test. And, you know, I just think that the yardage should be more around appropriate, around 6,000 yards. You know, even if since we're on the Olympics, the Olympic golf course for the LPGA was played at right at 6,300 yards, which is less than the average course
on the LPGA course.
But it should be around 6,000 yards.
Shoot the same winning score. I thought that was a very instructive week.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, Gil Hanse, this is a sharp guy and would have paid great attention to that. And that was more along the lines of an appropriate setup. But the closer you get to 6,000 yards, the closer you'll get to the proper setup for LPGA golf courses. And Beth Ann Nichols column, you know, she went into great detail. beyond just the mathematical comparisons. And she did a wonderful job with Colin. I think it raised the interest and the eyeballs of a lot of people who are in a position to right that wrong, so to speak.
I think it was a really provocative and instructive article, informational. I come at it a slightly different. One thing I do agree, certainly the par fives on the LPGA Tour would have more excitement, more scoring, more volatility if they shortened them and made more of them risk reward. And I do see a lot of, you know, probably more laying up on the LPGA Tour than on the men's tour, certainly. I'm not, but, you know, look at it from the other perspective, and this is something we've differed on. I don't like 7 irons, 8 irons into par fives for second shots on a regular, not a regular basis, but on a frequent basis. And I think that's what you're looking at if you shorten the par fives to 450 in that area for women. Most of the players will be able to reach it, some with irons, but some with middle to short irons. And I think that's when you get into the distortion, to me, of championship golf. And I think one reason we're looking at the comparison between the men and the women as so wide is because the men's game has progressed to a point where short irons and wedges are quite common now on the approaches to par fours, dramatically so, honestly, in the last 10 years or so, and maybe more since, and we've talked about this so much, you know, since the multi-layered ball came out in particular, but equipment and fitness, all kinds of things have caused the men's game to really progress in terms of more distance. And the women's game has not progressed as much. And so their setups now look out of proportion to the men's. But I would say you could make the argument the women's game is actually in better balance in terms of the clubs hit into the holes than the men's game. And so I wouldn't say necessarily that low scoring alone is evidence of quality, of high quality golf. You know, these majors you talk about, obviously Houston was an aberration because it was played, you know, at the end of the year in the middle of the winter. But, you know, having these longer or tougher setups for majors for women in particular, I think that's when everybody's paying attention to the women's game. And I think the skill factor does impress people at that point. I honestly don't feel like the women's game is shortchanged to the same degree, you know, Beth seemed to, portray in her article. I think the issue is a marketing issue. It's that for the casual fan or the fan who's, you know, looking at golf to be entertained, they want to see more birdies. And I get that. And that may be the overriding business decision that's necessary, but I don't think it necessarily matches. That's going to be the best golf. The best golf to me is the one that tests them and challenges them and shows who the best is. But not to the point that it's a baton death march of bogey trains and who can get it, you know, within a couple of strokes of par. I don't want to see that either. So it's nuanced, you know, and I do think the greater good was served by that article to kind of bring forth, first of all, an acknowledgement that women's golf does not, on the whole, by the mass audience, get the attention it deserves. It's not held in as much esteem as the men's game, as if it's some sort of inferior game. It's the best women in the world, and it's the best men in the world. And those two things should be, I think, in a perfect world, respected equally. They're not in most sports. I mean, I like the WNBA, I watch the NBA, and I would rather watch the NBA, but doesn't mean I don't like the WNBA. I think women's sports will have that battle for a while, but I like that they're pushing back against it and sort of getting their respect. I just hope it doesn't cheapen the challenge, so to speak, going forward.
Yeah. Well, look, here's where I think you're missing the point. Mm-hmm. If you set up a golf course that is so long that the longest hitters can't get to par fives,
well, that's
power does not dominate. Power dominates on the men's tour because the golf courses are set up appropriately. The last, you know, Yanni Sen certainly dominated the LPGA Tour for a brief period of time with power, and Annika Sorenstam and Lorena Ochoa did. But if you look at, say, Lydia Ko or MB Park, they're certainly not dominating with power. Power is exciting. And the LPGA Tour has, the men's tour is not, you know, it's not been played in a vacuum. The LPGA Tour has picked up yardage as well.
Yes.
Commensurate with what the men's have picked up. But the golf courses are so long that the longest hitters are not able to get to all the par fives and two. They're certainly not able to drive the drivable par fours. You think about Oakmont 2007, where Angel Cabrera won. Jim Furyk had a go at the drivable par four 17th hole and messed it up. But one of, if not the shortest hitter on the PGA Tour, is able to go for a drivable par four. Drivable means almost everybody in the field has a chance to go for it. An appropriate risk reward hole built or designed or set up with the best LPGA players in the world. If the golf courses were shorter, power would be more of an advantage on the LPGA Tour.
Well, Brandon,
it would dominate. And
I
it would
agree with you. I mean,
it would be an exciting watch to see players. You think about Jennifer Kupcho at the Augusta National Women's Amateur, the shot she hit on the 13th hole. That's her going for a par five and two. And that is, I believe that hole was set up somewhere in the neighborhood of 450 yards for her. 450 yards, if you do the math, is 530 yards, roughly speaking, for the men, which is right on the border of whether or not it should be a par five. Those are par fours. Some of those are par fours. So at the bare minimum, that's the shortest par five for LPGA, or should be. And 530 is at the bare minimum. Now, there are still par five shorter than that. But, you know, again, these things can be done with math. And power would, you know, I think we'd have a better chance of power stories, scoring stories, shuffling to the forefront of LPGA events. I think that would be more compelling personally.
Well, I don't disagree. I'm a huge fan of power. I mean, I think power should dominate golf. I think it's the greatest skill there is. Accurate power. That's what Nicklaus had. That's what Bobby Jones had. There's a continuum. You know, that's what Greg Norman had. Certainly that's what Tiger had. They weren't always the very, very best players, but they tend to be. And there's a good reason for it, because I think power dominates sports in general with skill. And I think at the moment on the LPGA Tour, there are several powerful players. They don't at this moment seem to have the all-around skill that would allow them to. In other words, if you shorten these courses, I don't think Lexi Thompson would suddenly be the number one player. She still lacks skill in certain scoring areas.
Well, Nelly Korda might.
She might, and she may get there anyway.
And you know,
in other words,
and Van Dam,
a problem.
And Van Dam might have a better shot of getting on all the par fives.
Well, she would. There's no question she would. You know, and yeah. But you played in an era. You know, there were guys who led the driving stats, and you know, often didn't keep their card. So, you know, I don't think there's an issue really with power players being thwarted just at the moment. There, I agree with you. There were opportunities for entertainment, rival par fours, more reachable par fives. I don't know that it would change the world ranking that much as it is right now, but that's okay. Either way, I love power being promoted and endorsed and in every sport. So I think sometimes because we disagree about the distance issue, I'm considered anti-power, and I'm not. I'm anti more distance, but I'm pro power. And it's just about proportions and relative to the field. You can, if there's not more distance, the more powerful player will still have the proportional advantage. And that's fine in my view. But anyway, the thing about the LPGA Tour that I see is I think some tweaks will help. And if it brings more attention, all the better. I just don't want to see it go overboard, because I don't think more birdies necessarily. I watched LPGA tournaments where it looked to me like the greens were pretty soft and pins were in the middle of the green a lot. And I know I would get criticized by women saying I'm cherry picking here. But, you know, we've seen 31 under win. We've seen 27 under win. There's a lot of birdies out there. They may not be the kind of birdies like the men's tour where it's, you know, 8-iron to par fives, but there's still a lot of birdies out there.
No, the scoring doesn't add up. It's not commensurate with the PGA
Tour.
It
may not be exactly, but there are moments. And as far as the majors, I like that it's tough in the majors. You know, I don't want to see drivable par fours or I don't want to see 450 par fours in the majors too often. Unless
450
it's
par five, you mean?
Like the 13th at Augusta. So anyway, look, I don't think we're disagreeing that much. I'm just not going. It's kind of like the Olympic thing. I don't quite condemn Dustin Johnson to the same extent. And I don't see the same extent of the problem that you see on the LPGA Tour. The respect is there, in my view, for knowledgeable golf fans. For the casual golf fan, they might be judging by the final score or how many 60s and 61s they see. And I don't think that's the best measure of where, whether really quality golf is being played.
Let me try one more time to bring you 100%. So here's a stereotype I hear, you know, all the LPGA, they're just not as good at putters. And if you look at the putting stats, putting averages, you know, 1.8, you know, 1.8 would pretty much put you in a very much of an impoverished position on the PGA Tour for putting averages, 1.8. That means you're one putting 20% of the time on the greens that you hit in regulation. And it's not bad on the LPGA Tour. So if you put those two side by side, you'd say, well, the men are better. And it's like, well, first of all, it's not an accurate measurement because you don't know exactly where those putts are coming from on the LPGA Tour, whereas you do on the PGA Tour.
Right.
But yeah, given the fact that they're coming in with much longer clubs, I think it's easily deduced that they're putting from much farther away. And when you see, you know, let's say Bryson DeChambeau and Van Dam drive it the exact same, you know, because of the tee setup, they give Ann Van Dam 40 yards in front of Bryson, and she drives at her standard 280 yards, and Bryson drives at 320 yards. Now they're the same distance, okay, to the green. And those whose job it is to set up a golf course say, there, we've done our job because we've mitigated the difference between the power difference between Ann Van Dam and Bryson DeChambeau. And boom, there they are. They're in the same spot. Then let's say they're 120 yards from the hole. Okay, that is a 60-degree sand wedge for Bryson, which means that his shot's going to come in much, much higher with much more spin. And Ann Van Dam, maybe she's coming in with a 52-degree wedge. So her shot would be at a flatter trajectory with less spin. Bryson's would land, let's say, right next to the hole and step next to the hole. Ann Van Dam's would roll 12 feet away. Bryson taps in for birdie. It's brilliant. It's exciting. Everybody jumps out of their chair and everybody politely applauds for Ann Van Dam. And then she misses her putt from 12 feet because odds are you are going to miss your putt from 12 feet. And she makes par. And the whole world says Bryson's just a better player. And that's just not accurate. It's just not accurate because those whose job it was to set up the golf course didn't take into account the trajectory and spin rate necessary to have the same landing trajectory, the same angle of descent and spin rate into the shot for Ann Van Dam, which means her tee should have been 80 yards, not 40 yards in front of Bryson, so that she could hit a 60-degree sand wedge. Same angle of descent, spin it the same, and knock it stiff to the hole, tap in for birdie, and her and Bryson are tied going to the next hole, not Bryson one ahead. That's my point.
I understand your point, but don't you think there's another dimension, and that's the firmness of the greens, and the PGA Tour's greens tend to be firmer. My visual experience, whatever, my on the ground experience, then the LP, so that angle of descent is mitigated by a softer landing. I mean, I think that's true.
There's no way to know that. There's no way to prove that. Okay. You know, there's zero way to, you can't prove that. I mean, that's a, you would never know that to be sure.
Well, I don't know. Talk to some setup guys. I don't know. I think guys who set up both courses would, you know, at the U.S. Open, for example, the USGA guys would know how they set up for the U.S. men's and the U.S. women's. Maybe that, you know, again, it's anecdotal.
There's no way to know that they've properly mitigated the trajectory and spin rates that and the angles.
Maybe they didn't scientifically do it. They just say,
one way to do it, and that is scientifically.
Well, it's also experience and the eye test of saying women need a little more cushion to stop the ball. That's not that scientific. You know, that's just,
they don't need a little more. They need to know exactly what they need. Okay, and you need to know exactly what their angles of descent are. Well, these are things that are easily measured, and spin rate and rollout rates.
We move on, but agree to disagree slightly, but not that much. Anyway, hey, let's talk about Rory and Bryson. We can talk about Rory, but I think the Bryson element that he talked about is pretty fascinating in that he conceded that, you know, from the U.S. Open at Wingfoot and what he saw from Bryson had gotten in his head that, you know, maybe I can Rory, I can improve taking that path, maybe even more than working on other things. And seems like his swing got a little discombobulated as a result. People have said, why would you ever do that, Rory? You're already one of the best, if not the best driver in the world. Personally, I thought it wasn't that big a leap for a top player to say, I'm going to take a risk here and maybe improve. Not sure he did it. In fact, I would guess very unlikely he did it with the same rigor that Bryson has done it. But I don't really castigate Rory for trying. I think the issue is, are you willing to go to the wall the way Bryson has gone to the wall? And if you don't, probably he's going to have an edge on you. But give me your perspective on Rory and with the subtext of Bryson, please.
Well, you know, it's, imagine being the very best at something, driving the golf ball, being known universally as the best driver of the golf ball in the world, and all of a sudden somebody comes along, and because of changes they make in their body and their golf swing, they trump you, they beat you. They're a better driver of the golf ball than you. That would get your attention. If somebody comes along, you're the fastest in the world, and because they change their technique, they change their training, they become faster than you. You know, who would not try to attack the differences? And, you know, I think this is an easy mistake to be made when looking at Bryson and just think it's about swinging fast. And I don't know exactly how Rory went about trying to swing faster. I don't know that exactly. So I can't comment as accurately as I'd like to. But what I do know is that, you know, I don't think he spent as much time in the simulator indoors trying to cultivate that speed. You know, I know that there are a lot of ways to get to where Bryson has gotten. It's hard work. You know, and it's easily missed the nuance of the moves that he's cultivated to not only hit it long, but hit it straight. And I think, you know, there are a lot of different ways to get there, but one of them is through exciting the muscles and cultivating the movements of the longest hitters, but also training at very, you know, and training at high speeds, but also training at very low speeds, ultra slow practice, so that you cultivate the accuracy elements and you get the accuracy elements into your golf swing. In my estimation, they're just as important as the fast elements. You know, this doesn't work if Bryson doesn't hit it straight. It doesn't right. work. We're not even talking about him. He doesn't become the driver. And those movements, you know, are practiced slowly, very slowly, to cultivate them. You know, I think this is one of the areas where I think the South Koreans are so successful, and we're not properly giving the South Koreans their due and how they're training so many formidable talents that make their way to the LPGA tours, that they train indoors, they train in simulators, and they rehearse slowly, and then they rehearse quickly, and they build up to those quick moves with slow moves. This is something easily overlooked. You know, the greatest pianist of all time is a fellow by the name of Sergei Rachmaninoff. And he had a unique perspective on training the proper moves on even pieces that he was brilliant at. He would use ultra slow practice, sometimes taking 20 seconds per bar. 20 seconds per bar was his pace for almost an hour on various pieces, so that he would get the movements perfected, that his brain would outpace the movements and not the other way around. And that I'm pretty sure is part of learning to hit the golf ball long and straight. And who, you know, I just don't think that Rory would have given the time to the accuracy elements combined with the power elements. And so he got into bad swing habits where he was, in my opinion, I've done a lot of comparisons of when he was playing his best in 2011 to 2014 to his golf swing this past year. And certainly with the irons, he was more on it. He was more covering it in the years when he was winning majors by 8. And he got into this sort of extending and jumping and not covering it, not getting on top of it, which leads to a lot of pull flips, which we saw a lot of with his iron game. So, you know, there's just a lot that went into what Bryson did. And that's why I'm such a fan of it, because it wasn't just about swinging hard. It was very calculated. And it has, you know, based in science, based in athletics, and it's been groundbreaking. And what Bryson has done is a game changer. He's not unlike Tiger Woods in that regard. I mean, Tiger brought better athletes to the game, just sort of a generation after he started. He brought, and so indirectly changed the way the game has played. But Bryson is directly changing the way people are training in real time in his generation. I mean, there will be a post-generational effect, but in real time, Bryson is changing the way people are training and the way people are trying to recruit and cultivate speed. But Bryson will be, you know, I think he's the tip of the iceberg. I think, you know, the same way, you know, you look at other sports, you know, the power of Martina Navratilova may have given us Serena. You know, I think Tiger may have given us DJ, and he may have given us Brooks Koepka, and he may have given us Rory, these great athletes. But Bryson is going to give us athletes that can tap into power through the use of knowledge, you know, rediscovered lost knowledge in the game. You know, that the only the longest hitters have been tapping into for the last 10, 20 years. Bryson's going to give us that. And so club head speeds, if you don't like power, and you don't, you know, you say you do, but I think you really don't. If you don't like power.
Hey, man, I was on top of Bryson. I don't mean to be arrogant here. I was on top of Bryson at Wingfoot. I mean, I was saying that is revolutionary. And people pushed back on that, said, hey, he just putted good. He just chipped great. I said, no, he's doing something that everybody's noticing and everybody's going to model. And they may do it as well as he does, and they may not, but there's going to be a residual effect, and it's happening. So I do like power, Brandle. I know, you know, it's easy, I guess, to misunderstand. Maybe I'm not explaining it or articulating it correctly.
Well, no, I know you like power.
I honestly believe, I mean, my favorite players have been the power players who can drive it long and straight. And I love that Bryson is emulating that. He's not just bombing and gouging it. Right. I mean, he has to, to some extent he has to, because there's just no way he can hit a lot of fairways. But he's doing it. He's missing in the right places. He's doing it so intelligently. And he's ahead of the curve in knowledge. And then he's ahead of the curve in work. And he's got a lot of ability. So what he's doing is no accident. And I'm with you. I mean, I agree with everything you just said. And I think you said it very well. And I'm not knocking Rory. He tried something. But to your point, it takes a lot. It takes all you got to commit right. to the kind of changes Bryson's doing. I don't know who's willing to do that. I mean, Tony Finau has, you know, he dabbled and he's got 206 in the bag without even trying that much. But he also knows if I alter my game, I'm taking a huge risk. I'm not willing to go there yet. Bryson's been the most courageous, along with being the most innovative. So, you know, I interrupted, but continue on because.
No, I was just saying, look, he's just the tip of the iceberg is what I'm saying. Yeah. You know, the kids in high school and college, they're watching what he's doing, and they're not, you know, I mean, Tiger sent people to the gym. Bryson's going to send them to the simulator, and the simulator is going to have a more lasting and less damaging effect than people going to the gym and overtraining. And I think that'll be the Bryson effect. And it's been great. It's been great, great theater. And, you know, I appreciate Rory's honesty talking about how he got into these, you know, sort of bad swing flaws of his swing faults. And, you know, hopefully he works his way out of it and gets, you know, more back to what he was doing when he was playing his best golf, 2011, 2014. But I mean, some of it has to do with, you know, Rory, the pandemic, and he wasn't able to see his regular coach. So, you know, he was doing some stuff on his own. And then when his coach did come over, he was, you know, he also went to see Butch and he's going to see Pete Cowan. And, you know, he's, you know, there's a lot of cooks in that kitchen. And, you know, I mean, you know, that's, you know, is that ideal? I don't know. I mean, Bryson DeChambeau has a lot of cooks in his kitchen as well. It's just Bryson loves a lot of information. I get the sense that Rory doesn't necessarily like a lot of information. He's more of a instinctive athlete, so to speak. More like a Sam Snead.
This has been a snapshot for Rory. I mean, he's still got, you know, time if he wants to alter some things. I mean, this is an ongoing journey, as you know. He may have taken a slight misstep. I don't think it's over in terms of his I love that he has a tremendous willingness to improve, because I think some of the questions about Rory is, does he have the same fire perhaps that a Tiger had or Bryson has? And if he does, he can channel that into practice and improvement and make another leap in his journey.
But you know, the thing is that, you know, I look at Rory as more along the lines of an intuitive, instinctive athlete like Seve. And
yeah,
and again, playing amateur psychologist here, when you see athletes like that try to become a more scientific sort of a, you know, Seve went to McIlgrady. I would hope you'd agree that didn't end up being a great coupling.
No, I agree. Of course.
You know, it would be like telling Bryson, you've got to be more intuitive and just go out there and let it go. It would go against the grain of everything that Bryson DeChambeau has done in his past or believes in. And I don't think Bryson would play his best golf there. And the same thing is true. I thought Sean Foley had an interesting comment at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, because he's now teaching Lydia Ko. So I called him because I saw him out on the range working with Justin Rose. I didn't realize Justin Rose had gone back to Sean Foley. And I just called Sean to ask him what he was working on with Justin Rose and how he was sort of reconciling the difference between Justin Rose and Lydia Ko, and congratulate him on his, because I think he turned Lydia Ko away from the mess she was in. And he said that Lydia Ko was in the habit of videoing every swing, going back and looking at it. He asked her why she was doing that. She said, well, Justin Rose does that. And he had a great line. He said, well, I told her that if Justin Rose wasn't a golfer, he'd be an engineer. And if you weren't a golfer, you'd be an artist. And so, you know, in essence, saying that he teaches Lydia Ko or hopes to teach Lydia Ko differently than he teaches Justin Rose, much in the same vein that Harvey Pennick taught Tom Kite and Ben Crenshaw differently. That's the role of a teacher, recognizing the strengths or the weaknesses, its tendencies of a player, and teaching them accordingly. So when I look at Rory, I don't see the same sort of never ending. Although I know Rory to be a lover of the golf swing and studying the golf swing, there are just not too many people that would get as forensic as Bryson DeChambeau does. And to try to get that forensic, one, it takes a lot of time, and two, it may not be in the best interest of the athlete.
Well, I think it makes, you know, again, great points. I want to get to something that you're working on now, your golf course. I just want to make one quick point about, having talked to Faldo and even Bryson, they both consider themselves, at least they certainly, now Faldo didn't have the science, resources that Bryson has, but he was very mechanical, quote unquote, with David Ledbetter. But he personally has always considered himself pretty intuitive as a learner. And Bryson is similar in that, you know, I like experimenting and messing around and keeping it loose. I'm definitely looking at every swing and every result in terms of the digital result and the analytical result, but I'm also looking for feels. And so it's a blend. And yes, there's no question Rory, at least outwardly, is not of the same scientific bent, but he can borrow from that and take and cherry pick it, so to speak, and incorporate it in his own way of learning. And I don't think it precludes him from getting a little more analytical about and taking advantage of some of this new technology and some of this new information that you just can't ignore is more scientific. I hope he doesn't, you know, have some sort of block that keeps him from incorporating that, because I think it's going to end up making everybody better, and they'll find ways to teach it in a way that you won't have to go to the same lengths that Bryson has had to go to as a pioneer. But anyway,
the most amazing thing, and we'll move on here in a minute, but the most amazing thing to me about Bryson's metamorphosis as a golfer was, you just mentioned Faldo, right? So Faldo famously took 2 years to make the changes to his golf swing. Tiger famously took 2 years, three different times, to make changes to his golf swing. I would call that the vertigo of creation. Bryson did not suffer from the vertigo of creation. Bryson went away at the pandemic, changed his golf swing, came back out, hit the ground running, didn't miss a beat. I think this, the ability to more accurately measure what you were previously doing, what you want to do, and to sort of leave breadcrumbs to where you can get back to where home base was, is the benefit of this generation. You know, Bryson did not have to suffer from the vertigo of creation. There were no 2 year. I mean, it was certainly worth the 2 year wait for Faldo because he went on to win six majors. But imagine if he could have started winning majors straight away.
He says it himself. He said, I wish I'd had what Bryson had.
Doesn't everybody?
Of course. And not just physically, but, you know, these resources, because his mind was tuned to that. And Chris Cuomo's been, you know, we both talk to Chris a lot. I think he's one of the foremost cutting edge minds the golf's ever seen. And
Chris has done his homework.
That metaphor is very, very important. You know, you got to be able to go back.
Chris goes around to all the various experts, learns, and, you know, I mean, he's amalgamated knowledge from various experts. And that's a good thing, you know, find people, you know, learn something from everybody.
Yeah.
And accumulate, a treasure chest of knowledge.
Let's talk about something that came up because of your, in our conversation earlier, because of your involvement, not involvement, but your thoughts about the LPGA and the setups and the design. You are now embarking on some golf architecture. You have a partnership with an experienced architect. You're now able to, make these ideas of yours and make them concrete and make them tangible. Tell us where this journey's taken you.
Well, there is a fellow that I've followed for years on social media, and I've certainly enjoyed his posts and learning from him. His name is Augustine Pisa. He has an architectural firm called Pisa Golf. He is one of only three architects in the world that is a member of the European Golf Course Architects Society in the United States, or America's Golf Course Architects Society. He's trained in vertical architecture. He's a proper architect. And he's also trained in what we'd call horizontal architecture, golf architects. He got his degree at the University of Edinburgh. So he's a highly educated man. He's a very artful man. He studied under Robert Van Hagee, Tom Fazio, Jack Nicklaus. So he's very well educated and certainly put in the time to become what he is, which is a very well respected architect in the world of golf course design. I'd written pieces about golf course architecture and where it was, in my view, sort of missing the boat in terms of challenging the best players in the world. I'd written pieces about the LPGA and golf course architecture. And in essence, wanting to start a dialogue with architects about how to mitigate whatever problems people perceive there being in the professional game with architecture. And also trying to solve the problem, the social dilemma, of the lack of time and attention that people are willing to give to the game of golf. So I started a dialogue. Augie reached out to me. Augustine is his proper name, but I call him Augie. Augie reached out to me, and I flew down to Mexico, met with him. We spent a lot of time looking at his work, me trying to get my arms around his philosophy, him trying to educate me. I'm embarking on a career golf course architecture, and I'm teaming up with, it's going to be called Pisa Chambly Golf Course Architecture Design. And we have a project outside of Monterrey, Mexico, in a place called Desertica. Desertica is unique because it's said to be where the first living organisms originated on planet Earth. It's sort of a mineral hot spring area.
First, yeah.
Yeah. And we're doing four six-hole loops, which actually gives you seven configurations of a golf course. One of those loops, per our conversation about Beth Ann Nichols' article, is going to be designed with the LPGA in mind, a golf course with their distances, their dispersion cones, et cetera, plotted out. A golf course designed with the LPGA in mind, so that the hazards are in the proper places, bunkers, rough widths, fairway widths, and so forth. But again, that's sort of the scientific or the sort of the left brain view of what we're doing. He's a great artist. His holes are stunning. You know, what I would never have known to call dynamic lines of architecture. You just look at it and it's intriguing. You know, I was, from an aesthetic appeal, his architecture was beautiful to me. So he's already got, you know, all kinds of interesting projects completed. He's doing, you know, golf concepts from a sustainability standpoint that fit on 10 acre plots of land that allow for, you know, 9 holes, believe it or not, to be played and looped around, and beautiful golf concepts, golf experiences. So he's, you know, he's incredibly creative. He's got both virtual reality or VR concepts up and running that, you know, I'm going to participate in. He's got his fingers in just about every single aspect of the game. He runs the first tee down in Mexico. So he's, you know, philanthropic as well. You know, he's just an incredible man. And that's, you know, it's a real privilege of mine just to spend time in his company. You know, he's one of those people where you're around him and you're impressed by his social awareness, I would say. You know, just, you know, he's a very good communicator. And yeah, I look forward to it. You know, golf course architecture is something I have been asked to do 4 or 5 times in my life. I've always sort of turned it down because I just didn't feel right. Didn't have the time to commit to it. And, you know, until I met him, and now I'm looking forward to it, diving in and hopefully creating some projects that make golf more approachable, to the masses, less time consuming, more sustainable. And then from a competitive standpoint, you know, the why is always important. Why are you designing a golf course? And, you know, at some point designing a golf course that offers a challenge, to the very best players in the world, that is also intriguing.
Well, it is intriguing. Your partnership's intriguing. It sounds like the synergy will be dynamic and innovative, and congratulations. And,
well, thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just, yeah, thank you. I'm looking forward to it. You know, I'm heading down after the Masters to start work on Desertica, and you know, I think that'd be you know, an incredible experience that certainly I'll be talking about all along the way, and I'll have Augie on, you know, maybe on this podcast, and we'll talk about it, because I do think, as I've looked at, you know, the golf experiences, Top Golf, virtual reality, golf, it's clear that golf, there is room for golf to expand in less traditional avenues. And so the new 9 is 6 and the new 18 is 12, or, you know, with upwards of, you know, the number of people that play video games is mind boggling. The percentage of people that play video games is mind boggling. And to try to find some appeal in a virtual reality world to those gamers out there is something that Augie and I and, you know, some incredibly talented engineers out there are trying to tap into.
Well, again, great pleasure. That was a hell of an hour and 12 minutes. Always,
yeah,
always,
absolutely. I will see you at the Masters, I suppose.
I'll see you. Are you on the show Sunday
at the match play,
Golf Central on Sunday? I think I'll be with you then.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be in next week for the match play. So I'll see you then. Thanks, Jaime. Always great talking to you, and see you down the road.
Same. Take care. Thanks for everybody to listening for listening, and see you next month. Take care.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.